Hello all, and welcome back to This Weird World. I wanted to share with you a really exciting adventure I went on recently. In preparation for season 2 of Weird World Adventures, I know I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but we are starting to film season 2, so I wanted to put that out there. I've been filming some uniquely wonderful episode segments across the world, and I most recently filmed an adventure in New Orleans following the trail to find the Seven Gates of Guinea. What are the Seven Gates of Guinea? It's a great question. It's likely that you haven't heard about the Seven Gates of Guinea yet, and if you have, you've likely not experienced them in a way I'm going to discuss here. The Seven Gates of Guinea are the seven gates that lead to, well, Guinea, the voodoo underworld. Naturally, the location of these gates are said to be in New Orleans, the voodoo capital of the world. But before we discuss more about these gates, let's talk about voodoo, a spiritual practice with a lot of misconceptions surrounding it in modern times. Voodoo was first brought to Louisiana by enslaved West Africans who practiced their own religions, one of which was a more concentrated form of voodoo. The same happened in Haiti, which is why voodoo was also very prominent in Haiti. At the time, slave owners were afraid of a slave revolt, something that did actually happen in Haiti, so they chose to allow slaves to practice their own forms of religion. Even so, Catholicism was heavily pushed upon these West African slaves, so many Catholic practices merged in with voodoo practices, creating a hybrid-like religion that was effectively voodoo Catholicism. Most of the voodoo found in New Orleans is very much its own form of voodoo Catholicism because of that reason. Unlike the dark reputation that voodoo gets, it's actually a religion that is heavily connected to nature and one's ancestors. The main belief is that there is one God who does exist, which is why it meshes so well with Catholicism. However, God doesn't interfere with the daily lives of man. Instead, spirits are regularly involved in our world and our connection to the other side. The most important and powerful spirits in voodoo are called loa, and voodoo rituals heavily involve situations that connect the living to the spirits and the loa around us. In fact, there are a lot of rituals in the religion of voodoo, and a lot of its practitioners believe in and practice many forms of holistic medicine and healing too. In fact, I have a very interesting sidebar to tell you all about voodoo dolls. While they have a menacing reputation for inflicting pain and curses on people, voodoo dolls actually started out with a much simpler and, I guess I'll say, kinder usage. They were actually just markers for notating what was wrong with someone. For instance, if you had a headache and you went to see a voodoo practitioner for a cure, they would take the doll and mark it in a way to remember that it was your doll. They'd then put a pin on the head to remind them that you came in for head pain. Then they'd add more pins to the head to indicate the severity of your headaches. They were actually used as markers so holistic healers could remember what was wrong with you the next time you came in. Basically, it's a more primitive version of a patient chart. But of course, ignorance and fear created a very different reputation for voodoo dolls, one that has lasted through until today. It's another great example, I guess, of people not understanding other cultures and not wanting to understand them, and instead just coming up with their own ideas. So, believe it or not, the voodoo doll actually started as more of just a patient chart or marker to notate what was wrong with someone and what the severity of that was. Now let's talk a little bit about Guinea, the voodoo underworld. Guinea is not exactly a place of enlightenment, and it's not exactly a place of punishment either. Instead, it's a place where the spirits go to reunite with their ancestors. Guinea is guarded by Baron Samedi, the main loa of death, often seen as a skeleton in a top hat. And I'm sure if you've ever been to New Orleans or even talked about voodoo before, you have seen Baron Samedi and just maybe not known it was him. He is the symbol of death and is believed to be the loa who brings people down to Guinea. So naturally, he is said to be waiting at the seventh and final gate of Guinea. To many, the seven gates of Guinea are seen as just a metaphor, each representing one of the 7 days a soul remains near its body on earth in the voodoo religion. Once 7 days have passed, only then can the soul be led safely into the land of the dead. This idea is crucial in the voodoo belief system, as it supposedly is the best time for a voodoo priest to make a zombie out of a body. Which, by the way, if you haven't heard about my mentor into the Explorers Club, Wade Davis, and his experiences in Haiti with the Haitian zombies. I highly recommend you go to my website, malloriesadventures.com, M-A-L-O-R-I-E-S, adventures.com, and search zombies, and the Haitian zombies and Wade Davis story will come up, and I very much encourage you to read it because it is wild, but I'm not going to get into that now. So we're talking about the seven gates of Guinea. Most see them as just a metaphor. Others believe that each of these gates actually have a distinct physical representation here on Earth, and that each gate has its own loa, guardian, standing between it and the world of the living. To access Guinea this way, one must specifically approach each of the gates and appease each of the guardians in a very specific order. Now, I was recently in New Orleans filming, as I said, and I theorized my own idea on where I believe these gates lie, and I visited each one based on my own theory. So you have to watch the full adventure on my upcoming episode of Weird World Adventures, but since it's in season 2 and it's not quite ready yet, in the meantime, I'm going to go a little bit more into detail about it here, so hopefully you can have your own adventure looking for the Gates of Guinea in New Orleans, and maybe you can get some inspiration into my ideas. Now, something that I thought was very interesting about going to hunt for the actual physical locations of the Gates of Guinea is that nobody's really done much about this and talked about it. I mean, people might have done it, but it's hard to find information on people actually going through with this and then talking about their experiences. And there were several ideas that people had about where the gates could be, but nobody pinpointed any specific gates or gave any actual evidence or information or even theories or speculations about where that could be. So I actually started from scratch, did a bunch of research, kind of, you know, pulled up a map, did some crazy stuff, and came up with my own theory here. So we're going to talk about that. But before we do, I'm going to go over the order of the gates, because the order of the gates is also actually important. And according to most resources, this is pretty publicly out there, the seven gates of Guinea must be approached in the following order. In other words, each gate has the following loa guarding it. The first gate is Baron LaCroix. The second gate is Guide Nibo. The third gate is Guide Plumash. The fourth gate is Baron Simetiabi. The fifth gate is Guide Babako. And the sixth gate is Baron Criminal. And of course, the seventh and final gate is guarded by none other than Baron Samedi himself. So let's talk a little bit about my adventures finding the Gates of Guinea. I have heard many different rumors on where the Gates of Guinea might lie. Most believe that they are found in the infamous above-ground cemeteries in New Orleans. Others had a different idea. Based on some of the most exciting theories I researched, I thought we could put the symbol, or veve, of Baron Samedi, the symbol of death himself, over the map of New Orleans, with the center of his cross landing on Canal Street and Basin Street. When I first placed the sigil on the map with that in mind, I noticed that most of the spots of the stars on Baron Samedi's veve landed on, like, landmarks that made sense. It was actually pretty wild how much sense it made. It was a thought that produced some pretty cool results, so I had to kind of follow with it at that point. They were thematic and appropriate to one of the guardians of the underworld. And when I discovered that it would have put the top star of his sigil on Marie Laveau's tomb herself, well, then I knew this was the exact theory I'd be working with. With all of that in mind, I have a little sigil here of what my map actually looked like. I had the order in which I needed to approach the loa, and now I had a map of seven locations, all matching with the corresponding loa that I matched up with the spots based on their personalities and what worked best with the seven star locations on the map that I laid in. And this is going to be what I theorized here below. I'm going to tell you in a second, but first of all, you have to see this picture of this map, because it's just, I felt very, like, validated, excited. I don't know. It piqued all of my curiosity and interest because it looked really cool. Like something you'd see out of Sherlock Holmes. So if you go to malloriesadventures.com, and you search for Seven Gates of Guinea. All this will come up because, of course, I had to put it in a blog format. And in there, there will be a picture of this sigil of Baron Samedi laid across the map of the French Quarter of New Orleans. And it's pretty amazing. So please check it out. Here's what I came up with based on that information. So I decided that I would visit the first gate, which I put together as the Capitol on Baron. First of all, it was on Baron Street. So I figured that I would expect to find one of the barons here. Baron LaCroix is the most suave and sophisticated of the Deathloa and pushes for the expression of lust and sexuality. So a high-end wedding location on Baron Street seemed like the perfect spot to pin him at. For the second gate, the Tulane Center for Advanced Medical Stimulation and Team Training, a high-stakes medical training facility, seemed to be the perfect place to find Guide Nibo, the Loa, who was considered a great healer. The third gate, this one's pretty good, I put at a strip club, and it was really a shady place. It was underneath two highway passes. It was, and the reviews on Google were just not great either. But it fit, and it was perfect. With a crass sense of humor and an ability to wear many masks, and accept them as offerings, of course, a strip club seemed a likely, appropriate fit for Guide Plumage, as the guests and visitors here all likely wear many masks. I couldn't help but leave a mask here as an offering for Guide Plumage, because many do leave him mask offerings. And I also may have left a dollar bill in it because I just couldn't help myself. For the fourth gate, it lined up with St. Louis Cemetery number 2. As the doorman between the living and the dead, a cemetery spot just makes sense for Baron Cimetière. The fifth gate, I put it at Willa Jean's Southern Kitchen. With no special traits or abilities to note, known as the unnoticed brother, the nice taste of some Southern cooking at Willa Jean just seemed like a fit here. It's familiar here in the southern charm of New Orleans, yet particularly exceptional and delicious, as Guide Babaco reminds us to stand out even if we don't naturally. The sixth gate happened to land perfectly at the Museum of Death for a Loa who is cruel, thought to be the first murdered, and who demands the sacrifice of chickens burned alive so he can hear them scream. This seemed like a perfect fit for Baron Criminal. The fact that this spot crossed perfectly at the other end of the sigil from St. Louis Cemetery number 2, with Marie Laveau's tomb in the center above them, it's pretty wild. Of course, I wouldn't be caught dead sacrificing a chicken, so the stuffed animals and dead bodies found at the Museum of Death will have to do instead. The seventh and final gate I put at the tomb of Marie Laveau, which makes so much sense and was really freaky that it just kind of happened to land there. Marie Laveau's tomb would make sense to be the seventh and final star, the one at the top where you can find Baron Samedi and where the final gates to hell supposedly lie. She was the third female leader of voodoo in New Orleans, and she maintained her authority until she passed away. So this makes sense that Baron Samedi himself would be found there. In fact, there's a legend that if you draw 3 X marks on her tomb, turn around 3 times, and knock on the tomb, if you speak your wish, it will be granted. If it is, you must come back here and circle your wish and leave an offering. The officials in New Orleans, of course, now heavily discourage this old practice. So this was irritating and I also understandable, I guess, where people were very much vandalizing, specifically that cemetery, but really, I mean, a lot of the above-ground cemeteries there. Someone had not too long ago hopped over the fence at this cemetery here and painted Marie Laveau's tomb bright pink. And, you know, before that, people are scratching in it and leaving X's and all this nonsense. So they got upset about it. And rather than just hiring a full-time guard to sit at, you know, Marie Laveau's tomb, which is probably what I would have done, they instead decided to capitalize on it more and they have a guard sitting at the entrance to the cemetery. And now you have to go across to a center and buy tickets with a guide. You have to show up with a guide they provide as you buy tickets in order to access the cemetery at all. And, you know, this kind of sucks because it is like a public, you know, it's a public park, like how many times you have to pay to enter a cemetery, but it is what it is. So now you actually have to pay for a guide to be able to go in, and it's very expensive to see this. So that was kind of unfortunate there. So now if you want to go, you have to schedule a tour to enter to see Marie Laveau's tombs or any of them there. And you most surely cannot defile them in any way, of course. Regardless, we showed up to Marie Laveau's final resting place after conducting visits to the other locations we believed to be the six gates to the voodoo underworld. And as we arrived to the seventh, here's what we found. It's hard to express the fun, excitement, and total awe that came out of this adventure to find each of the gates of Guinea and to approach them in what seemed to be the appropriate order. To see the outcome, you're going to have to watch the new episode of Weird World Adventures featuring New Orleans and our hunt for the Seven Gates of Guinea. However, I will tease you with this for now. While the underworld may not have opened up for us and welcomed us in, there was a natural phenomena that appeared the second we arrived at the last gate and gave an offering to Baron 70, and it was pretty wild. The whole thing was an exciting journey, well worth the ride. And I'd love to hear your thoughts and theories on the Seven Gates of Guinea and where you think they might be, if you have any ideas. It's funny how much information doesn't exist out there about this. Like, you can find little hints, little bits and pieces, but, you know, I found little clues along the way that kind of got me to this outcome. I also wanted to take the moment to talk a little bit more about the idea of the voodoo doll being utilized as a patient chart. Here's a little more articulate piece I kind of put together on that. And then I'd like to go into a little bit more information about Marie Laveau, because how can I not talk about New Orleans and not talk more about Marie Laveau? So as I mentioned, it may seem strange to link the voodoo dolls with medicine. However, according to the voodoo practitioners I spoke with in New Orleans, these infamous dolls would work originally as a patient chart, so to speak. Voodoo practitioners would work as holistic healers, and when people would come in to see them to find cures, they would create a doll to match the person who came in, which is why you put something of theirs on the doll, and then put the needles in to indicate where the pain was and how much pain was being experienced. So if you came in with a headache, they would put a pin on the head that indicated the headache. Multiple pins would indicate more pain, and then the more pins you put in, the more pain you were having. So according to my source, voodoo dolls were actually used as tools to record patient information and help as a tool to heal rather than as a tool to inflict pain or suffering. Thanks to the negative association with voodoo dolls over time, with countless movies and famous stories showcasing them as a tool to inflict harm, they are now not prominent in Haitian or Louisianian voodoo anymore. They have effectively been denounced by those in New Orleans today and are utilized as more of a gimmicky souvenir to sell to tourists. So it kind of like, I mean, the fact that it was taken and just sensationalized as something bad, it's actually kind of been moved out of the religion and not really utilized in the practice anymore. And I mean, now we have better ways to indicate, you know, patient charts as well. It's also important to point out that the use of effigies and figurines throughout various cultures and religions, it's a common practice dating back at least as far as the Upper Paleolithic period with the Venus figurines. Doll-like idols have been worshipped, idolized, and used as a part of various rituals with different intentions throughout human history. They've been used to heal, for good and bad purposes, and with a variety of intentions. Revenge dolls were utilized in Assyrian rituals, Greco-Roman curses, and Mesopotamian cultures, to name just a few. But the voodoo doll was not created for such a purpose. These dolls likely came from the African religion brought into the New World with African slaves. Specifically in New Orleans, after combining with Catholicism to create the incarnation of voodoo that we know in Louisiana, which we kind of refer to as voodoo Catholicism, these fetish dolls were still utilized in many rituals as they were in Africa. Just again, not in a negative way as was believed by many. Aside from the use as a medical chart, voodoo practitioners were also known to make dolls as a way to help people heal and as a way to communicate with the spirits of those who had passed on. Supposedly, when hung from trees, practitioners believe that they opened the lines of communications with those who had recently passed away. Pwen dolls were also hung in rituals to attract certain loa, the spirits who are believed to intervene in the daily lives of humans. And a Pwen doll could potentially also look like a voodoo doll and confuse those who don't understand the religion, which could have also helped with the rise of the negative connotation of the voodoo doll. All in all, I found this history and use to be quite fascinating, as it fully reverses the meaning of what we would believe a voodoo doll actually was. The voodoo doll being used in an early form of a patient chart by holistic healers is just one of the many ways we, as humans, see something innocent from another culture that we don't understand and begin to spread stories and rumors rather than to try to understand and ask questions. So again, this is something that's been drilled in me as I've been studying anthropology. It's really about understanding other cultures and asking questions and not judging. All right, and before I go, I want to talk a little bit more about Marie Laveau, because I did get to do a really fun voodoo tour experience when I was there. And, you know, she was really just on top of being, you know, one of the most famous voodoo practitioners, herbalists, and midwives in New Orleans pretty much of all time, and being, you know, like the voodoo queen. She also was a fantastic showman. She really did know how to create the illusion that she was all-powerful and instill, you know, a sense of fear and awe to everyone around her. They said that she would dress up in one outfit, and then her daughters, once they grew up, kind of looked a lot like her. So she would dress them like her in the exact same clothing, and they would walk around different areas around the town to make it look like she was in multiple places at once. It was a great way to instill a little bit of fear and respect so people took her seriously and didn't question her power. But before we go into that a little bit more, I want to talk about some of her early life. She was born a free woman of color in New Orleans in today's French Quarter. At the time of her birth, Louisiana was still under Spanish rule, so it was a colonial Spanish area. Her mother was a free woman of color of African, European, and Native American ancestry, and her mother was not married at the time of her birth, so her father was not identified on her baptismal record. But many people believe her father to be Charles Laveau, who was a somewhat important person in Louisiana in that time, which is why she gets called Marie Laveau. She married Jacques Paris, a quadroon free man of color who had fled the refuge of the Haitian Revolution in the former French colony of Saint-Dominique. Their marriage certificate is preserved at the St. Louis Cathedral in New Orleans, and he was a part of a large white and Creole of color immigration of refugees to New Orleans in 1809 after the Haitian Revolution. They had two daughters, both of who were kind of stated to take on the role of Marie Laveau late in her life and then after she died. The interesting thing is that both of her daughters just disappeared from records entirely in the 1820s, which is just another mystery kind of incorporated in her life. She dated a lot of noble Frenchmen. She was very respected for that reason. She had the class, and she also was friends with many of the noble people around the area because she was providing services to them, and she kind of had her own little rumor mill, so to speak. She was kind of like the spider of, if you watched or read A Song of Ice and Fire, you know, she's kind of like the spider. She has informants everywhere, so she knew everything about everyone, which of course would help preserve that image of power for her. And it also was great because she knew anything about everyone and knew everything that was happening around her town. Despite having all these tricks and being such a showman and looking like she was in many places at the same time and collecting information on people, Marie Laveau was actually a dedicated practitioner of voodoo. She was a healer, an herbalist, an entrepreneur. She did do a lot of good for a lot of people too, and she was known as a prominent female religious leader and community activist. She actually started as a hairdresser for wealthy families. So again, that's right away how she's gathering a lot of the information to start about these families, because people talk to their hairdressers more than anyone else about all of their little secrets. And she used this information during her voodoo consultations with wealthy Orleanian women to enhance her image as a clairvoyant, and then use this intel to give them practical advice. And she also made money by selling her clients gree-gree charms to help their wishes come true. She passed away on June 15th of 1881, and the different spellings of her surname result in many different women with the same name in New Orleans at that time. So her age at death is conflicting based on the source, and that's also why there's been some confusion about where she was buried, though people now believe for sure they know exactly which tomb it is, which you'll see on the tour if you go to visit it at the cemetery in New Orleans. But there were several what they would call faux levo tombs that people used to believe she was buried in. And despite being a pretty powerful person in New Orleans, having class, having secrets, having power, her legacy and name surrounding her and the lore that came from it has made her pretty much immortal throughout time. It's lasted and is probably much more impressionable now than she was when she was alive. She's been used in many, 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 many iterations of literature. She has had bands made after her, had songs made after her. She was put into a season of American Horror Story, I believe. So her legacy lives on to this day. And I think it's something so unique and so different and so ingrained in voodoo culture that I can honestly say she's probably one of the most important legendary figures of all time. So it was really exciting to get to, you know, follow in her footsteps a little bit in New Orleans and to get to see her final resting place as part of our adventure. I will also say something I wish I would have explored more when we were in New Orleans was the vampire culture. There is a large vampire culture in New Orleans and many hidden bars and cool experiences. And one of the newest places that we got to go to, which was really exciting, was the Vampire Apothecary. It's a bar and restaurant and little shop. It has a little bit of everything. They have, you know, herbs and teas that you can actually buy there. Really amazing drinks that are incredibly unique. It has a wild atmosphere. It's unlike anything else you've been to, and that was my favorite stop in New Orleans. So make sure if you're in New Orleans, you check out the Vampire Apothecary too, because it's new and I want to see it there the next time I go to New Orleans. So I can't wait for you guys to watch this episode of Weird World Adventures once it airs. I hope you appreciated this little teaser in the meantime. And until next week, I hope you all stay weird.